Calling to order the Programs, Projects, and Operations Subcommittee for November 7th, 2017. A copy of the Open Meeting Act is posted at the back of the room and out in the hallway. With that quorum call, please. We have two excused absences tonight for Patrick Leahy and Jim Thompson, and Tim Fowler and Chairman Dave Klug will fill their positions. With that, roll call, please.
Brent Conley?
Here.
Fowler?
Here.
Klug?
Here.
Caesar?
Here.
And Shepherd?
Yes. Item 4, adoption of the agenda.
So moved.
Second.
Roll call.
Brent Conley?
Yes.
Yes. I have here an affidavit of proof of publication of tonight's meeting that will become part of the permanent records. Now moving to item 6 is a review and recommendation on grant request and district cost share for Glacier Creek Prairie Reserve. Amanda Grant and Dr. Tom Bragg with UNO. Good evening.
An old map, but UNO and the district have been partners for many years working on purchasing land around Allwine Prairie, also called now the Glacier Creek Preserve. And we have for a number of years, last probably 3 or 4 years, been very actively looking for additional funding, different kinds of state, federal grants, private foundations. We've been working really hard, and I was recently reminded by one of the women we work with on the grant application that we should take a step back and just take a second and see how far we've come. So I thought that's probably a good place to start for tonight. Allwine Prairie was 160 acres originally, and it was donated to UNO in 1959. Today it's 424 acres, and the NRD's been a partner on a number of the tracks. The Papio track was purchased with the UNO and the Papio NRD in 2009. The Barbie Hayes Overlook was purchased in, I think, 2013. And we did a lot of work with NRCS ag easement that we were awarded and then eventually unsuccessful because of some issues with 144th Street and the county road plan. But that was eventually purchased in 2013. And then from 2013 to 2015, there was a really big push to purchase this west watershed here that's about 104 acres and the north tract here that's just about 100 acres, 101 acres. And these pieces, along with the Papio tract and the Hayes Overlook, are really were part of a development that's owned by NS, the Heritage, and it was preliminary platted. And it was intended to be residential housing. So we've really been working very hard to purchase this from the developer before it becomes houses in order to keep this prairie intact. And so, see, 2013 to 2015, big push to raise money to purchase this piece. Then the Papio NRD contributed quite a bit. And by 2015, which was our timeline with the developer, there was only enough money to purchase this west watershed. It's called the Bootalua Track now. And so that piece was closed down and is now part of the prairie. So the part that's left from the NS, the Heritage, the development that is slated for houses, is this north track, 100 acres, just about. And it sits, you can see where it sits. It's got some pretty unique features. And I'm going to let Dr. Bragg talk about the critical ecosystem portions of the project and maybe some educational things that are going on, and also UNO's efforts in funding, raising funds to purchase this tract, and then I'll jump back in and we'll talk about our request of the NRD board.
So can you switch that other button? That's our wetland, that blue spot. This is the preserve itself. This is kind of the current boundaries are in yellow. And that's the area that we just were talking about. The area we're looking at is this north track. We call it north track only because it's on the north. And as you can see, that it's right abuts the preserve on the north side. There's been particular features of this that we think are really important. I've tried to summarize some of the highlight some of them. The hill mass, just to go back real quickly, this hill mass right here actually controls a lot of the water flows out of this area. So one of our major concerns is that hill mass, if it were developed, it would affect we're concerned it would affect the hydrology that feeds a whole number of natural features on it, particularly the spring seeps and all that kind of thing. It also affects the water quality of North Creek. It's down, basically it's the hill that flows down to the North Creek, and I'll show a couple maps of that in just a second. Connects the preserved historic spring-fed wetland, and there's some boundary issues. So just to kind of go to some pictures, there's a unique feature there. On the slope, because of the geology of the area, there's actually springs that feed out on the slope of the hill. They sort of creep down the slope for maybe 2 or 3 meters, and they go back underground again. And on these areas here, we have sort of a seep on the slope. We call those slope wetlands is what they're called. And just as an example, this is what a slope wetland is. Whoops. Far more sense. So this is basically, there's willows, there's equisetum, there's cattails, and it's above the lowland, what you'd expect along the creek. And those particular features occur in several places along the preserve. This area is what we're trying to acquire, and I'm just showing you what the features are that are in there that we're trying, where they are, because this is what's important. We're also concerned that affecting this hill mass, if they develop houses on there, that will affect the hydrology for this entire slope, which also feeds the Glacier Creek area. The preserve, all this addition would also connect to a historic wetland that's been there a long time. It's got beaver dams, crayfish, the whole bit in that area. It's a spring-fed wetland. And so we would be adjacent to that and try to work with the homeowners there to try to get control of that, or at least affect some control. And the farmer that farms this area in yellow here, is so rocky and so wet they can't farm it. And there's nothing there but grass right now. Not native grasses, but it is grass. Just suggesting that the hydrology of this slope is particularly unique. That makes it a particularly important resource for at least ecologically, unique ecosystems and all that. Among the other things that benefit from this, I kind of mentioned just earlier that there's a number of things, et cetera, at the bottom. There's about 4,000 students that come through the place right now. We're beginning to beat paths to all the good sites. We're trying to expand the area so we can actually increase the number of places where classes can go. One of the things about this is the preserve of the Allwine Prairie. This is the north part of what's called the North Creek. Not a very original name, but it's what we call it. But this is an area that is already platted to be, or already scheduled to be, a stream and wetland bank eventually by the NRD. And this whole hill mass feeds into that. So there is a big impact. Whatever goes on this hill mass is going to have some impact to that slope area as well. So the north track, this piece here, has a lot of critical features to it. It adds to what we can use for the source, a lot of diversity in the ecosystems that are there, and also it affects the hydrology and some of the area that's being restored. Just real quickly, a summary. This is kind of a real quick. This is land acquisition. This is what we spent so far. It includes the NRD money and the different monies that have been in there. And this is kind of where we are at this particular point. I will point out that the private donor is Barbie Hayes. She's donated both to the structure itself and also to land acquisition. So except for one exception in here, she's a major contributor, the only outside donor. The rest has been NRD, Environmental Trust. So this is basically what we need to have. We've got this much so far. From the NET, we have this much already. Barbie's donated the remainder that you can see here, leaving 1.7. The North Track purchase is a total of 3.5, so basically 1.7 is what's left. We have an NET grant in for 880, whether it happens or not. Last year it didn't make it, so these are just things that are out there we're hoping to try to get. We have the Kiewit Foundation that the NRD, I think, is helping us work with. If we get some of that or all of that, that's another 880. So that's getting close to that total amount. And there's an easement program, the Ag Land Easement ACP. I can't get all that straight. That tongue twister. And that would be roughly the same amount. And then Barbie has also said that she's willing to kind of contribute to the rest of this to try to make sure that this happens. So we're really reasonably confident that this is going to happen. This is just kind of where we stand financially now, including the amount we've already contributed. So we've done a lot to create this unique, this neat site within the metropolitan area. We've got the high ground. We've got enough land around it. I think we have a great resource. It's a great combination of the efforts by the NRD, NET, and UNO, and then the private donor.
Yeah, and then if you haven't been out there, it's really, really amazing. Prairie land is just, it's actually not preserved as much as you would hope it would be, especially for our heritage. And it's very amazing. And the amount, you didn't talk a lot, and we could talk all day about the educational opportunities. It is open to the public. There's tons of grade school kids. There's lots of master's students, college students doing research, and all kinds of really awesome projects going on out there. But for consideration for the NRD board tonight, what we'd like to recommend is that we have approval to submit for the Peter Kiewit Foundation grant again. We did apply for that in a couple of years ago. We got some feedback. We've done a lot of work and updated our application, and we'd like to apply for that again. Dr. Bragg mentioned we can, as a governmental entity, we can apply for 25% of the total land price, so that would be $880,000. That's the max we could get, but we'd like to apply for that. The second thing we'd like to apply for is the NRCS, the ACEP ALE Ag Easement Program, and that is pretty lengthy application process, and in the end, if you're successful, you get 50% of the value of the easement over the land, and so it's not the full land price, it's an easement value. But what that means is then the NRD would hold title to that land, and in perpetuity it would remain in agriculture. A prairie is an acceptable use, and we've been through that process with them, so we know that we're eligible, and we know if they have funding at the NRCS, it's a pretty, it's a project that's certainly, we think, has some success, or we could have some success with. And then the last piece of this is that I'd like to recommend and request a district contribution of $300,000 to be paid over a two-year period, starting next fiscal year and fiscal year 20. So $150,000 each year towards the purchase of that north. With that, if there's any questions.
Oh, the chair would entertain a motion on this item.
Move with staff recommendation.
Second.
I have a motion and a second. Anyone in the public wish to speak? Seeing none, directors?
I have a clarification. The $300,000 that the district is committing, that is the maximum amount for the two-year period. It could, depending on the funding sources, could be less. So if all of those grant opportunities come in, we could reduce our contribution. But ours is kind of a, one, it's a placeholder for the shortage, if there is one. And two, when you deal with private grants, they like to see public participation. So I think that was one of our weaknesses for the previous grant, is the NRD really didn't have any money in that current application. And so now it shows that we have commitment. So that's why that is in there.
There's so much to talk about. We forgot about two major things. That is one. That was one key piece of the feedback that, you know, even though the NRD has contributed towards purchases in years past, the preference would be that there's some additional contribution this time. The other really key piece to all of this is that when that West Bootalua track was purchased, the UNO did purchase also an option on the North tract, and it set the price at what the developer paid, or what they had asked, $35,000 per acre until December 2018. And so that's really the urgency of why we're here and we're trying to get all of these applications in and get some funding lined up so that we can close by the end of this year.
Thank you, Amanda. Other comments or questions? Director Weiss.
Are they afraid that the price would go up after that?
We don't know what they will do after December 2018. I don't think anyone will give up until there's a house on the land, but we don't know, and we'd sure like to.
Be nice to look the other way.
The danger is that it would expire, and then they would build up. I mean, that's the risk.
That's the risk. They could develop it, right, for example. That's our concern.
Right. Other questions or comments?
Director Jeff. Clarification. We've thus far contributed $1.5 million. Correct. Over what period?
Since 2009 was the first purchase.
Who does the maintenance?
University of Nebraska at Omaha is responsible for the management of the entire site. As we acquire new land, it just comes under our department. And they have a commitment in that sense because they are contributing two staff positions as well as the time of myself, faculty time. So that's the contribution that UNO does, not so much the dollar amount now, but it's into the future. They're permanent lines in the budget.
Director Bradley.
I want to say I wholeheartedly endorse.
Any other questions or comments? Roll call on the motion, please.
Oliver?
Yes.
Blue?
Yes.
Ed Conley?
Aye.
Beezer?
Yes.
And
yes. Thank you. Now we're moving on to agenda item 7 is amendment number 2 to the professional service contract with HDR Engineering for Zirinsky Basin number 2. Amanda, you up again?
I'm up again. Yes, I won't leave. Tonight for consideration is a second amendment to the Zirinsky Basin 2 professional services. And I think John Engel is here. I see with HDR if we have any questions for him. After it's been 2016, we started in a professional services contract for the design of Zirinsky Basin 2. And maybe we can go to the map, Mike. It's just, this was the last of the four planned water quality basins for Zirinsky 2. And it's about 204th and F Street. And we're approaching just about finishing final design, getting ready to bid the project this winter. And we had a few out-of-scope items come up. So we had an Amendment 1, and that added final design and construction administration. So this amendment is just an additional, basically a change order to the contract for some out-of-scope items. And the main things really had to deal with the geotechnical. The embankment for the structure. It sits right here along, this is West Center, 204th. So the embankment is right here, and there's the property that we have acquired for the project is really wet, and we didn't have a lot of places to bring embankment in, and so we had to do some additional monitoring wells and some geotechnical work to assess what amount of material we'd be able to take from the pool and use for the embankment. And so that was some additional work that we did. We had some out-of-scope work for the 404 permit. The Corps of Engineers requested some additional analysis that we had not thought needed to be done. Just the other day, we heard again from the Corps that they maybe didn't need as much as they thought. So actually, So we probably, this is an hourly not to exceed, so we probably will not use all of that amount. But that was one item we had in the change order here, or the amendment, sorry. We also had to do some additional modeling and analysis for the weir and the chute spillway for the DNR. We have a really tight space to work because Grandview development is going on right here, and Blue Sage development is underway here. Houses are already built, and so we had to shift our design a little bit because we were limited in space. And when we shifted our design to kind of a non-traditional weir structure, we had to provide additional modeling. Other than that, just some kind of incidental things. We had to carry, because of the development going on here, public roads end, and so we're going to carry some access roads into the site and then just extend the project management by about 5 months. So the details should be attached with their amendment, but if you have any questions, I'd be happy to try to answer them, or John is here as well.
Would you read the management recommendation, and we'll get a motion on it, please?
Yes. So management recommends that the subcommittee recommend to the board the general manager be authorized to execute amendment number 2 of the professional services agreement with HDR Engineering for the Zirinsky Water Quality Basin number 2 project in the amount not to exceed $56,200, and that would bring the total contract amount not to exceed amount to $1,335,860.
Chair would entertain a motion.
Motion for staff recommendation.
Is there a second, please?
Second.
We have a second. Anyone in the public wish to speak on this? Seeing none. Directors? Roll call, please.
Blue?
Yes.
Jesus?
Yes.
Fred Conley?
Aye.
Fowler?
Yes.
Yes. Now you got the next item, Amanda, also. Okay, it's your night tonight. This is renewal of USGS maintenance agreement for the Papio flood warning system gauges. You want to go ahead on that one, please?
Yes. This is our annual renewal of the contract with USGS to maintain our flood warning gauge system. We have 22 gauges throughout the Papio Creek watershed, and we've had these since 1993, but in 2012, we really updated all the equipment, and then at that time, we hired USGS to do the maintenance and operation of these gauges, and they've been doing a great job since then. The new things this year, the total amount is $193,925 for the year, and that it is higher than we've seen in the past, but what we're in the process of doing is upgrading the transmission from radio transmission to satellite transmission, and we've 2 years ago we did 4, last year we did 6, and then we'll plan to do the remaining sites this year. So $35,000 of that is to the upgrade that satellite transmission. And just a kind of as an added bonus with that, once we get them all updated, USGS is entirely taking over that element of the equipment. If there's any transmission, you know, repair equipment or pieces or anything, they will handle that, and the district wouldn't be responsible for that. And also we've just our radio transmission equipment was outdated. It was working, but it's just going to be time. So I think it's a really good move for that site. USGS is cost sharing $16,550 through their cooperative match funds, and then another $19,335 through their groundwater and stream flow information program. So they put some money into this as well. The only other new thing this year is that we are going to run 2 gauges year-round. Usually we have them operational from March to October, but we did, with the last 2 Decembers, we've had some pretty major rainfall in December, and so we thought, you know, Omaha was really interested in doing that, and we've been thinking that that would be a good idea. So 2 of the sites we will maintain a little bit longer, and Omaha is going to cost share a little more. They're going to split that additional fee with us. We do have an agreement where Douglas County, the city, and Sarpy all help us pay for this. So the city of Omaha, in this case, both the gauges are within the city that are going to be year-round, so they will help pay that little extra. Other than that, I think that's all really the data we've been getting back has been awesome for the last several years. And just so, you know, we've been using that data, that data we collected from our flood gauges was able to be used for calibration data when we updated the Big Little West Papio hydrology. So it was really helpful in that regard, helped us get a realistic picture of what flows were. Also brand new this year, we used this data in a homicide case, and so it was an interesting case. And the data was reliable and able to be submitted.
Would you like to give us management's recommendation?
Yeah. Management recommends that the subcommittee recommend to the board that the general manager be authorized to execute the proposed joint funding agreement with the USGS in the amount of $158,040 in district funds for the operation of the district's flood warning system for 2018, subject to changes deemed necessary by the general manager.
Chair to entertain a motion.
Okay.
Director Teaser, thank you. Is there a second? Director Klug. Anyone in the public wish to speak? Seeing none, directors? Yes, Director Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You said there was 22 gauges, and I see on this map 19. Where's the other 3?
The other 3 would be just rain only gauges, and they are, there's one by Epley, Hitchcock Park, we're outside of the watershed, so a couple of the gauges are rain only, and they don't stay.
And do we have any of these type gauges anywhere else in our district?
We do not. The district does not. USGS, they have Waterloo. You know, USGS has gauges that they maintain on the Elkhorn River, Platte River, Missouri River. Do you know of any others in our district? I don't know that they have any on any other streams in the district.
Okay. And I was also wondering, just for general purpose, is there any more gauges outstate?
There are.
Okay. So, okay, good. So just as it can give us a warning for flood, can it let us know when the water's becoming too low? Above water.
Well, I'm sure on the on the Platte, there's gauges all along the Platte. And if you
irrigation districts that may be drawing over more than they're allotted, and we can almost pinpoint or to a certain degree who that may be.
There's a link on the memo in that first paragraph, and that link takes you to the National Weather Service River and Lake Forecast website, and that has all the gauges in the country, but the district's flood warning gauges are included in that too, but you can, you know, pan around and look at any of them in Nebraska if you want to.
Well, thank you.
Any other questions or comments? Seeing none, roll call, please, or motion, please.
We got a motion.
Roll call. Yeah, roll call and a motion, please.
Chamber?
Yes.
Brent
Conley?
Aye. Fowler?
Yes.
Blue?
Yes.
Yes. So now we're going on to item 9, which is the dedication of right-of-way and easements to the city of Papillion for 120th Street improvements. Go ahead, Amanda.
One more, and then I'll get out of here. Okay, maybe the math again, Mike, if we can. So this is just the dedication of some easements to the city of Papillion, and this is on land that the district has purchased for the WP6 flood control reservoir. And there's a lot of development going on in this area as well. Here's Cornhusker, 114th Street, 120th. So the city of Papillion, on a separate project, was working on design for improvements to 120th Street. And so these easements are just easements that they're requesting for us for work that they're doing on improving 120th Street. I thought this showed it, but it must not. But the three easements they're requesting are, it's a permanent right-of-way dedication of 17 extra feet on this east side of 120th. Then they've requested a small easement that extends the box culvert on this drainage way through 120th. And then the last easement is a temporary construction easement that's about 50 feet wide that just goes along this east side of 120th for the construction of the road work. We've looked at the timing of the project with our project. It doesn't have any impact to our project, and so we recommend approval of the temporary construction easement, a permanent storm sewer and drainage easement, and also the dedication of that street right-of-way to the city of Papillion for the 120th Street improvements.
Okay, Chair, to entertain a motion.
Move a staff recommendation.
I have a second. Amanda, who's going to operate this? Let's wait on that. I'd like to get any public input first. Anyone in the public wish to speak? Okay, now, who's going to operate this site once we complete it?
The city of Papillion would take over ownership immediately because this is that parcel that they had annexed when they had that big annexation package a year or so ago that went and annexed Prairie Queen. So W6 is in the city.
Thank you. Other questions or comments by directors? Seeing none, roll call, please.
Brent Conley?
Aye.
Fowler?
Yes.
Cliff?
Yes.
Caesar?
Yes.
Fincher?
Yes. Thank you, Amanda. Next, Paul Woodward. Item 10. This is review and recommendation on the Lower Platte River Basin Coalition Interlocal Agreement Number 2.
Hi, good evening. We're here tonight to go over and consider an interlocal agreement between six other NRDs besides ourselves and DNR. But we're going to go through a brief presentation. With me tonight is John Engel. He's a project manager with HDR. Might also note also with us is Dustin Wilcox with NERD. He serves, so currently for the coalition and going forward in the agreement, he would serve as the coordinator for this whole planning coalition. So I'll let John, if you want to fire up the PowerPoint presentation, he'll go through that. Yep, that one. Just a good intro. Well, thank you. My name is John Engel. I'm with HDR. Appreciate the opportunity to be here. I was here, it was about a year ago. We had the, and gave a briefing. We had the nuts and bolts and the content of the plan finalized last October. And there were some details, and as they say, the devil is in the details. And so I thought I'd give you a brief refresher on the planning activities and the planning document, tell you what we've accomplished over the last year and hammering out some of the final details, and then kind of summarize the key points of the plan. The basin planning effort was a partnership amongst nine entities. The DNR and the seven NRDs that constitute the Lower Platte Basin, and as Paul mentioned, Dustin Wilcox and the NARD served as a coordinating role in the development of the plan. An idea of the basin, this is you can see the Lower Platte drainage basin and its extents and the NRDs that are either entirely or partially part of the Lower Platte Basin. They include the upper and lower Elkhorn, the upper and lower Loop NRDs, and then the Lower Platte North, the Lower Platte South, and the Papio Missouri River NRD. And it's a basin that's really unique in that it is so diverse from a land use, from a topography, from a water source and rainfall, from a population standpoint. It's kind of unique in the state, too, that by and large, it's a pretty water-rich basin. There's plenty of water. There are times of shortage in both time and place, but this effort was really to capitalize and preserve and be proactive in managing the abundant water resources of this basin. The purposes of the project, and really rolled into the three goals that the plan was built around, was first really develop a robust water supply and use inventory and get a full picture of the uses and the supplies that exist within the basin. The second goal is really developing a plan that maintains a balance between those current uses and supplies as well as future uses and supplies. And the third is focused kind of on the fact that that water supply is abundant, is to implement policies and practices that contribute to the protection of those existing uses while allowing for smart and responsible future water development within the basin. And that's really the three goals that the plan built upon. Over the course of the last couple of years, there's been a lot of project activities. Certainly the goals that we just mentioned and the objectives and action items to support those. There was a lot of cataloging of existing data and data collection activities by each of the member NRDs in the Lower Platte, as well as looking for gaps in data and what could help them as they go forward with implementation and where were some uncertainties in supplies or uses that may be helpful. We documented the existing surface and groundwater controls, each NRD, what are the practices they're currently employing, as well as the DNR on the management side of surface and groundwater use and also catalog those used throughout the rest of the state. We evaluated the DNR's insight methodology, which is really a database that the state of Nebraska has developed, the DNR specifically, and it looks at all of the consumptive and non-consumptive uses of water throughout the state, both ground and surface water, as well as the demands on those water supplies. And so we looked at that as a tool and adopted it to really utilize and tracking of supplies and uses within the Lower Platte Basin. We looked at some conjunctive management opportunities, that's using surface and groundwater together to improve the reliability and the resiliency of the supply for both. We looked extensively into the water banking systems that exist in Nebraska and throughout the West and what applicability they might have to the Lower Platte Basin as you go into implementation. And then this was all done in concert with the technical committee, primarily made up of technical staff from the NRDs and the DNR, the management committee, and then the coalition board itself. The components of the plan, there's and I didn't bring the hard copy of the entire plan, but the document of the plan itself, the main document has a purpose and scope, gives a description of the general basin hydrology and the predominant uses and supplies, outlines the goals and the objectives to support those goals, and then there's the plan components and action items. And then through implementation, it provides some guidelines on the plan review and reporting on an annual basis to make sure you're tracking towards achieving those goals and objectives. The entire document has a lot of the supporting appendices, and there was a lot of activities in the action items that were completed as part of this effort. Some of it was data collection, as I referenced, you know, the documentation of the surface and groundwater controls, the evaluation of the basin-wide accounting, the existing data and data collection recommendations, a summary of some of the conjunctive management opportunities that were looked at throughout the basin, a summary of the water banking research and some of the key elements of water banks and considerations for the coalition, and then all the documentation of the facilitation and coordination through the technical management and coalition board meetings. The highlight of the recommendations was to adopt the basin-wide accounting methodology to catalog those uses and supplies. We put in a five-year first increment with an annual meeting of the coalition members to coordinate activities, to report on progress, on goals and objectives, and set the course for the next year. One of the bigger discussion items was placing a limit on allowable development during the next five-year increment, and we based that on gauge flows at the Lewisville gauge, and I'll talk a little bit more about that. But it kind of fits in with that vein of there is a lot of water in the basin, and let's take baby steps in being responsible to allow some of that development to occur and capitalize on those supplies. And so a target was picked on what would be a reasonable amount of stream depletion by the group, and it was based on the peak season, which is the primary June, July, August season when the droughts occur, so it's very conservative, but it does still allow some future development to occur over this first five-year increment to track those effects, and then will be reviewed in the second phase of the plan. And as I said, it's got a five-year update, which is coincident with the department updating their supply and use inventory on the InSight database. So as I said, the devil was in the details. So the activities since I was here in October, one of the primary items, and Dustin and Marlon can, I'll have a quiz on if you can tell me where the Beaver Creek sub-basin is. but it was a we spent a couple months talking about it, and we're very familiar with where it is now. I'll get to that in a second. Essentially, with the department originally, I'll come back to this slide. Originally, the department in their evaluation and development of uses and supplies for their purposes, they had defined the Loop Basin as starting just upstream of the Loop hydropower diversion. And they did that for some of their administrative reasons. But for our purposes, from a basin-wide, when we start looking at the Loop Basin, the Elkhorn Basin, and the Lower Platte Basin, it made sense to extend the Loop River Basin to the confluence with the Platte River. And what that did is, Paul's pointing out, that green area that he's outlining. Oh, there's a small one.
Go to that one.
Yeah, this.
Right.
So this right here is the Beaver Creek Basin. And as you can see, the way the department had broke it out, it was included in this lower Platte overall basin. And they revised that so that it is actually part of the Loop Basin, which is where it comes in. It's a tributary to the Loop River. It comes in just downstream. It's a siphon that goes underneath the Loop Power Canal and comes in between Genoa and the confluence with the Platte River in the Loop Basin. And so so that was one of the big discussion items, and it looks like a you know, on a map, it's a pretty trivial exercise to include it in the basin. But as far as accounting for the supplies and uses that occur, the department took a couple months and kind of redid their analysis of supplies and uses for each basin. And so that was completed. And once that was done, the basin-wide accounting was updated. The plan document itself went through a series of reviews, and a final draft was produced in May, and in June was provided to the technical and management committees for their review. And then we had a meeting in September, which got some final edits. It's been finalized, and the interlocal agreement was developed. After that September meeting, I'll get into a little bit more about the allowable development piece. There was meetings with amongst the NRDs to partition the allowable development from the sub-basins to individual NRDs, and that has occurred and been completed over the last couple months. So this piece on the first increment development, what we see is, if you look on an average basis over the last 25 years and look at the supplies and demands within the basin at Lewisville, there's about during the peak season, June, July, August, there's an excess of about 190,000 acre feet of water. And what the group said during this first increment, again, responsible development, let's say that we'll use 10% of that allowable development in the first increment. And that's in the right-hand column, you'll see that's the 18,807 acre-feet of new use that would be allowed. And then that was broken into the three sub-basins, which is the Elkhorn River Basin, the Loop River Basin we just spoke about, and the Lower Platte. And it was partitioned to those basins based on the contribution of supply. So the Loop provides about 46% of the basin water supply at Lewisville. It got 46% of the 18,000, which is the 8,651. Likewise, the Elkhorn provides about 32% of the basin water supply at Lewisville. Its portion was 6,000 acre feet. The Lower Platte sub-basins provided 22%, and so the Lower Platte, three NRDs in the Lower Platte, were allotted 4,138 acre feet during the first increment. That was in the plan document, and then over the last couple months, the NRDs, the Loop Basin NRDs, the Upper and Lower Loop, the Elkhorn Basin NRDs, the Upper and Lower Elkhorn, and the three NRDs and the Lower Platte River have met and have partitioned largely using that same approach of what is each NRD's contribution to supply to further break down the allowable development by NRD, so each NRD has a number they can manage to over the first increment. And these are the numbers that are incorporated into the plan. The Lower Platte River breakout of that 4,100 acre feet is 21% to the Papio, 24% to the Lower Platte South, and 55% to the Lower Platte North.
So I kind of wanted to review then what this means to us as we look at the interlocal agreement and how do these numbers kind of affect us. We do have some advantages going forward. And a bit, I guess first, technically, we don't think that any one of those numbers based on the levels of conservatism that we've taken necessarily give anybody a blank check to start doing too much that's going to really affect our water supply. But then us as an NRD, just like all the other NRDs, for anything that occurs above Lewisville, we'll have to account for these different things. So as part of that amount of water that you saw, we would have to keep track of and allow any new crop irrigation. So that's going to be both from groundwater, which the districts would oversee, and from surface water, which DNR would oversee. So out of that amount, we have to break up a certain amount between us and DNR as to who's going to manage what. Any new industrial wells that come into the basin would be a new use, would have to be accounted for. New municipal uses above what's currently permitted. So this is an important part. Our bigger, most and several of our municipalities have already an existing permit through DNR that says you're allotted this much annual water use. And currently, for instance, MUD's two well fields, especially the west one would be above Lewisville that we'd have to be concerned about in the first place, has a lot of room for growth. So that growth can occur without us having to redo any of these numbers or keep track of it at this point in time. The same kind of for Lincoln at the way it goes. I guess where we're currently at is that communities like Valley, other ones that don't have a special permit, they did have a certain current water use that was already involved in the calculations, like an existing use today. We need to figure out how that's going to continue to be permitted without tracking each new home that comes into the city. Some of those things are so minute that we just need to have a better way of managing them. So that's kind of still to be figured out. I wanted to point out that any new surface water projects, like, for instance, a new lake that occurs somewhere in the drainage that comes to the Elkhorn River, that would kind of have to be looked at and accounted for because that evaporation is going to occur. That's more than what's currently the land use is giving off, so that would have to account for. The kind of nice thing for our entity is we can continue to work on the Southern Sarpy watershed projects and things like that without the concern that those have to be accounted for because they come in downstream of Lewisville. So that gives you an eye shot of what we need to do. How does this, getting back to kind of the memo and how does this involve with the plan? So the interlocal agreement currently is what we're approving tonight. That interlocal agreement does incorporate and adopt the plan. So it does break up those numbers between each of the NRDs, and that's what we'd be given going forward. It does continue the three boards, the three committees that John outlined. So their work would still continue. Especially as we do that annual review every year. That'd be kind of their portion is to review what everybody approved and go back and recalculate everything. And then you do that every year, and at the end of 5 years, you really have kind of a gut check about, okay, what did us approving this development really do? And that reruns it into a point where you can be ready to go to the next 5 years. So that's the point of that. And then just to note that, you know, we noted that drought conditions can and already do occur. Obviously, doing further development won't necessarily improve those. We don't know how much it would affect them right now, only that drought could occur still. So there is a continuation of some of the ideas that we looked at in this plan, and plus moving forward in the drought mitigation study, with which we're a part of, with Lower Platte North, Lower Platte South, and then the two Lincoln and MUD water systems. So that'll continue. We'll come up with ways that we can improve the drought condition by continuing to not halt everything that's going on within this basin. So, with that, John, I would take any questions you might have.
What's Paul, why don't you give us a staff recommendation on this item?
Okay. The management recommends that the subcommittee recommend to the Board of Directors that the general manager be authorized to execute the proposed Lower Platte River Basin Water Management Plan Coalition Interlocal Agreement Number 2, subject to changes deemed necessary by the general manager and approval as formed by district legal counsel.
Chair to entertain a motion on this.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Anyone in the public wish to speak on this item? Seeing none, directors? Director Jeff.
I've always got a question. Realistically, what if we don't approve it? What are the consequences? What happens?
Currently, we have a limitation per our integrated management plan about what we're allowing as far as irrigation development right now. How those uses fit in with those other things I mentioned would still have to be addressed. But really, the idea of the plan is that if everybody can agree to this, this goes down, this then goes into your IMPs between you and DNR, and you update those to match what this says, and then everybody's following along the same page. I guess if us or any other NRD decided not to go along with that, they would still just be subject to their own requirements. Some of those are similar to what we have, like only allowing 2,500 acres a year
right.
of new cropland.
I remember
cropland.
Talking about that before. This. I was wondering, how does this conflict with that? Or
all it really does is it would probably, so in the future, by the future I mean the next 3 to 4 months, we'll probably be working on an update to our integrated management plan that would require a modification to that 2,500 acres.
Who enforces this?
The NRD enforces the groundwater allotments. The requirement, there is no formal requirement for us to actually adopt a basin plan at the time. This is a voluntary effort on all of these NRDs' part. It would only become a requirement if we got to that threshold where we don't have any excess flow anymore and we have to start accounting for making up for what we've overshot.
The overall goal is to make it to prevent us from going into an over-appropriated or fully appropriated status with DNR. And once that occurs, then there's all kinds of restrictions and regulations and complications that go with that. So there's not, in this agreement, there's really no, besides peer pressure and everybody self-monitoring and self-reporting, there's really no mechanism for enforcement except for the fact that all these other districts don't want to go into that over-appropriate, fully appropriated status as well. So,
how close are we to ever having that happen?
Well, we almost have the designation 2009, and then it was reevaluated, and we weren't. But so it's been discussed before, and it's evaluated, and so it's something that we want to make sure we can continue to hold on to that surplus as long as we can. It's a good management tool. Eventually, I hope we get to the point where we will have what I want to call a drought playbook. So we will have things figured out to the point that if there is an extended drought, that we will know what mitigation actually works. And so we're not forced like other Western states when they were in the middle of a drought. They were just throwing things against the wall to see if they could increase their capacity and increase their volumes. Well, we hope to get to the point where working with all of these other districts that supply us with the majority of our water, that we have something that we can go to and say, we know this will work because we've already have the agreement, we've already worked it out, and we think this has a fairly good chance of working. So at least from our perspective, we're at the bottom of the funnel, so to speak. And so we're really going to rely on a lot of cooperation from those other basins to, if we really do get in trouble, then we have a great agreement. We've got a system to rely on to make sure that we can at least mitigate that until the drought conditions subside. That's, I think, the overall goal from our perspective.
Are there other questions or comments, please?
I just had a couple. The plan, the I guess the implementation of the plan and the enforcement is really comes at the local level on the NRDs and their adoption of the IMP when they accept those. And I, to John's point, it's kind of interesting in talking with the NRDs, you know, down here at the lower part of the basin, you know, that everyone has a desire to avoid a fully appropriated determination just because it really limits your flexibility on the things you can do within your water management. You kind of ties your hands. But, you know, down here at the bottom part of the basin, really concerned about 40,000 acres going up in the Loop Basin, and there's nothing you can do about it without some sort of a plan. Or when you go up and talk with them, they're very, very concerned about growth of population down here, and they don't want to be, they don't want checks to be written that they're going to have to pay for. So it kind of brings both parties together in that there's a common playbook, there's some certainty, at least over the next 5 years, this is what we're going to be doing, and it's not going to take us off a cliff.
My question, are they on board with the fact that we're going to try and restrict their water use up there in the Loop Basin so that we have plenty of water down here? They're going to shut off the irrigation systems up there?
They've got their same amount of allowable development, yeah.
They're okay with that?
We'll find out Thursday.
Any other questions or comments, please? Director Bradley.
Well, this sort of goes to those USGS gauges I was talking about previously, or we were. And is it groundwater and surface water, or just groundwater? Is it the whole hydrologic
side? It's both, yeah. It's the whole.
Okay. And I see we're at the PEP. Deputy Missouri NRD, 21%, our first five-year increment allowable new development, 21%, and some of the other basins, 68, 75, another 55, and what I'm getting at, we will have, we do have explosive growth right now in the metro. You know, it's that, you know, that's what I'm saying, does that handcuff us a little bit, or that prohibit us.
You pulled the presentation back up.
You want to take a shot at this, please?
Yeah. I think basically in my description there that the current allotment that the permits allow what MUD would have for water sources from the MUD West along the Platte out there, it won't hamstring us at all for the foreseeable future as far as that goes. If we do need to start doing additional water planning for municipal growth, that will come into play, I think, over the next 5 years. I think we're going to do kind of a study to make sure we're going to be able to account for that in the future. So
for those the baseline, those other municipality uses. But like MUD's Platte West well field, they utilize maybe 60% of the capacity on at most currently, and the full 100% has been represented in the analysis, so they'll be able to build out to that full 100% of their existing capacity. It wouldn't count against anything on their allowable. That wouldn't be considered new development, I guess.
And the way I think EBD's system is set up, they're accounting for development to continue throughout the entire Papillion Creek watershed, in addition to some other places around the perimeter of the watershed.
And the Platte well field south, or the Platte pipe, is not even included because it's below the Louisville gate. So that could grow as
whatever. I've got a question for one of you. How does this southern Sarpy County water system, whatever it becomes, how does that play into this? It is below the Louisville gauge, but what impact will that have, or how will it be impacted by this agreement?
I don't think it would be impacted by this plan at all. A similar thing happens on the south side of the river in the lower Platte South, where there's a portion of their NRD below Cass County, and those will just be regulated according to the current NRD IMPs.
Thank you. Other questions or comments? Roll call on the motion, please.
Fowler?
Yes.
Luke?
Yes.
Beezer?
Yes.
Aye. Yes. Thank you, gentlemen.
I did have one last plug for the Paul had mentioned the drought mitigation study in the consortium. NET is going to has a I think it's a radio spot that I was interviewed for last week, and they interviewed I think maybe MUD and Lincoln Water, and I don't know, John, or they might have interviewed, but I don't think there's a NPR local station. So they're going to.
Yeah, there is.
Yeah, she said she was going to send me a link. I'll forward it to
95.
John. Yeah, I'll send you the link for those that may be interested in to forward around to the interview on. And it's about the consortium's project, the drought mitigation plan in the Lower Platte.
Thank you. Marlon, go ahead.
I just wanted to mention, too, this really is, landmark legislation. It really is this is the first, I believe, basin plan in Nebraska. It covers third of the state. The Republican NRDs don't even have a basin. You hear about them all the time. But this is 7 NRD states working together to say how to be best managed in this part. It really is a very
thanks, Marlon. We're moving now to item 11. This is the Waterloo, Nebraska Groundwater Elevation and Temperature Gauge Joint Funding Agreement with USGS.
All right, good evening. This is kind of a continuation of Amanda's discussion on the flood warning system, in that this particular groundwater gauge and temperature gauge, which are next to the Waterloo gauge on the Elkhorn River, were actually part of her previous funding agreement. And what's kind of been decided is that gauge is now being used as part of an ongoing study that Chris Hobso with USGS is here to give you a little update on tonight. So that ongoing study is looking at groundwater levels between the two rivers and how do they change as the flow in the rivers change, and what does that look like. So really what we have in front of us to approve tonight is just a very small interlocal agreement with or joint funding agreement with USGS just to cover the maintenance of this groundwater gauge over the next year. But I wanted to take the opportunity to let Chris update you on the whole project so you can see how it's being utilized. So if you go to the presentation. Yep.
Hi, my name is Chris Hobso, a hydrologist with the USGS, and I'm giving you guys, everyone here, an update on the project that Paul and I are calling the Platte and Elkhorn River Valley Integrated Water Monitoring Project. We got this money, kind of all this money pulled together for this project from a number of sources. We got a water sustainability grant back in late 2015. Obviously, our project partners are Pappy, Missouri NRD and also Lower Platte North NRD. And we're also able to get some money in from Nebraska Department of Natural Resources through some of their InSight funds as well. And are also contributing some USGS co-op dollars. So this is a project Paul and I have been kind of working on jointly. And so it kind of fits into what John was talking about earlier in this Lower Platte Basin water supply issues that sometimes we run into. The Lower Platte River Basin is the primary drinking water supply for over 790,000 Nebraskans. These are some figures that we took off our grant application in 2015, so they probably changed. But when flows get below 1,000 CFS or cubic feet per second, it really affects the ability of MUD and Lincoln Water to supply water to all those people. And it's occurred 105 times in the past 27 years. So kind of in response to that and some other concerns as well, the Department of Natural Resources, they work with these 7 different NRDs to come up with this Lower Platte River Basin Water Management Plan to address other issues that will also kind of mitigate flows and kind of get to that, kind of feed into some other things that are going on too. And so, one of the things that they were discussing as part of this plan is the potential for using maybe stream flow retiming projects. And the idea behind that is you have these times where you have excess flows coming down the Platte River. So you have a huge snowpack in Colorado or flooding up a basin. Is there a way that we can kind of capture those flows and then release them downstream to lower parts of the Platte Basin in times where we're, you know, kind of approaching that 1,000 CFS threshold? And for those plans to be successful, we really need to understand how streams and aquifers interact with each other. So that's a critical part to that piece.
So this is kind of grew off over the idea sprouted for this because we talked a lot about doing groundwater modeling in between the two rivers. And a lot of that was kind of looking at different scenarios. But what this does is really taking a physical look at how exactly does this aquifer and everything react to each other. So we'll have a lot of this actually measured data to go back to if and when we ever do decide to try to figure out more about what's going on.
So kind of just a brief kind of primer on everything. I think everyone here knows that water and is exchanged between streams and aquifers. And there's two scenarios that we generally see. There's a gaining stream scenario, which we see on the left. So the water table is above the level of the river. And as we move downstream, the groundwater is actually feeding the river, and we're actually picking up and increasing our stream flow. So we call that a gaining stream or a situation of groundwater discharge. And then the opposite is on the right-hand side where our water table is below that of the stream surface. So as we move downstream, we're actually decreasing our stream flow. And so we call that a losing stream where we actually have groundwater recharge. The Platte and the Overland Rivers, I'm sure everyone's well aware, they're hydrologically connected to their aquifers. And depending on the flow conditions, and I'll show some data to kind of back this up, the Platte and the Elkhorn, they can be losing or gaining. So it just kind of depends on the conditions in which we're looking at the streams. So we have kind of a unique situation with the Platte and the Elkhorn River just above their confluence. So here's a look at our study area. It's a little bit faint, a little bit hard to see, but it's this area outlined here. So the Platte River downstream of Fremont, and then we've got Arlington. So the Elkhorn River downstream of Arlington down to their confluence right there. The Platte River has a gradient of 4.4 feet per mile. So what that means is every mile that you flow downstream in the Platte River, it drops 4.4 feet in elevation. That's what we mean by gradient. The Elkhorn River is a little bit different. So every mile that it flows downstream, it drops 2.5 feet. And so when we have this unique situation, so I've got this cross section here from La Chera to the town of Waterloo, since there's that difference in gradient, there's about a 40-foot elevation difference between the two rivers. And they're separated, you know, the town of Valley, if you've driven through this area, you know it's basically flat as a pancake. So we can infer that since the rivers are connected to their aquifers, that we have groundwater flow from the higher spot here on the Platte River and then moving east towards the Elkhorn River. And so we can kind of demonstrate that with this cross-section that we put together here. So what we don't know is how different flow conditions affect this. If we have really high flows in the Platte, really high flows in the Elkhorn, or drought conditions for that matter, and if we have sustained drought and a lot of groundwater pumping, how does this relationship kind of, how does it change over time? So that's what a lot of this project's trying to hit at. So here's a couple example cross sections. I would have liked to update this spreadsheet with some different information, but kind of shows how September 8th we have kind of low conditions. So it's kind of the end of our pumping season. We have a runoff event. You can see those water levels kind of bump up and how that kind of propagates down towards the Elkhorn River as well. So one of the tools that we used to kind of assess and look at this relationship was the continuous groundwater levels near our stream gauge. So that's kind of what this funding agreement's about. We had one at La Chera, and we also had one installed at Waterloo. And I'm going to show you some data from our site at La Chera. And so here's our USGS stream gauge, and here's a monitoring well. And this is going to be on the east side of the river on some, the Platte River Landing? Is that the name of the property?
Yeah.
Okay, Platte River Landing. So there's a picnic area and a boat ramp and everything. That's going to be on the east side of the river here. And so that's right there. We got a share stream gauge and well. And then I'm going to show you some data. We dropped in some recording equipment on a well that the Lower Platte North NRD owns on the west side of the river, about 300 feet. So here's a look at some water level data. So this axis here, we've got the date. So this is looking at the whole entirety of the project. And we've got our land surface elevation here. And so we can see in red, we see the Platte River elevation. And for the most part, early on in this study, it's higher than our groundwater level elevation. So that kind of indicates we've got a losing stream. So this is going to be east of the river here. And as we kind of move further into this project, They're basically plotting on top of each other, so we have it's kind of a neutral. It's not really gaining nor losing this particular case. And if we pick up that that well, it's west of the river. We can see we got our elevations quite a bit higher than the Platte River. And so basically we're gaining water from the west, and it's flowing towards the east. So it's kind of substantiating what we already know. And one thing I want to point out is that relationship is really consistent. Even if we have this really high, we had a big runoff event here right at the beginning of September. That river is still pretty much below the level of the groundwater on that west side. So that shows you some of the continuous data we collected. We also did some synoptic water level surveys, where instead of collecting data a handful of points over a period of time, we kind of took our entire study area, collected as much water level data as we could over a very short period of time, and kind of looked at inferred groundwater flow paths based on that. And we chose a couple of different time periods. November of last year, it was at the after the growing season, the streams, everything's had time to recover. We had pretty high flows in the Platte and the Elkhorn River, and we did this low flow condition. So kind of towards the tail end of the growing season, where the flows of the Platte were quite a bit lower. Had we had a different different kind of water year drought conditions, those dates or those kinds of periods would have been adjusted accordingly. But the data we put into this, we looked at water levels from 30 different wells, Papio wells, Lower Platte North wells, and MUD wells. We surveyed in with survey grade GPS equipment about 100 surface water bodies. So these are streams, sand pits, road ditches, anything that we could see that was connected to the groundwater system. And we also collected some some stream flow measurements as well. So to kind of give you kind of more of a hydrologic context of when these surveys took place, I got all the stream flow data for the Elkhorn River. So what you're seeing in this this gold line down here at the bottom, that's the average flow of the Elkhorn River over time. And that's based on 89 years of record. And so what I plot up here in the blue, that was our measured stream flow in blue at the Elkhorn River at Waterloo during this entire project. So you can tell that this entire project, while it's been going on, the flows in the Elkhorn have been way, way above normal. And then here I got the Platte River at LaShera. So this is the gold line based on 22 years of record. That's what the annual flows look like. And basically when we first started this project, the flows were really, really high. And for the most part, they've been maybe a little bit high, but mostly average. When we did those synoptic water level surveys, just to give you a sense of when those were, that's where these red lines here. We had really high flows in the Elkhorn, a little bit above normal here in the Platte. And then when we did our summer surveys, about normal, and then also about normal as well. So it kind of gives you an idea of what, when we look at these maps coming up, kind of how they fit into the big picture. And so here's a look at, we had a network of water level, groundwater wells and water level sensors from the west. So there's our Platte River, LaShera. This is those wells here. And we have our Elkhorn River at Waterloo down here. You can kind of see how we have this pretty consistent relationship from west to east of groundwater flow in that particular transect. And those are what our water level surveys fit in. So when we pick these, synoptic water level sites, basically we chose some areas. We had this area to the north where we have Big Slough and Rawhide Creek in the old channel. Where there's this kind of network of road ditches that were kind of acting as groundwater drains and feeding these tributaries. So you had a high water table, pretty fine-grained sediments, and it's carrying all the water towards the Elkhorn River. We also saw a similar situation here down here to the south. We had this little tributary and a lot of road ditches and wet areas that carry that water to the south. One thing we also noticed, there's a lot less high-capacity wells up here to the north. If you're familiar with the airborne electromagnetic surveys that were done, there was a line that was collected kind of right in here, and then stops just south of Big Slough, but right at about that dividing line. The aquifer up here is relatively thin. It's pretty fine-grained. And then the aquifer down here, where we have all that sand and gravel mining, it's really thick, really permeable, and we've got a lot of water movement here.
It's kind of like there's a shelf that drops off, and there's a lot thicker sand and gravel from valley south.
And so here's a look at the water level map that we created based on that November 2016 map, water level data. And so what we generated was this contour map. And the way that we can look at and kind of interpret this data, so all these different lines are lines of equal elevation, and we have a 5-foot contour interval. So our high data is over here, and the drain, our lower data is over here. So the way we look at and interpret it, if you're a drop of water, you're going to flow perpendicular to each one of those lines. If I'm a drop of water right here, I'm going to be perpendicular, perpendicular, perpendicular. I'm going to be captured by Big Slough, and then I'm going to move downstream to the Elkhorn River and then kind of leave the study area along the Elkhorn River. So that's how we kind of look at and interpret that. So to the north, groundwater flows generally the east or southeast towards those tributaries, as you're seeing there. And then to the south, it's generally where we have all these different sand pits and this really permeable thick aquifer that flows generally to the south or southeast. And it looks like that the west of the Platte, the water is generally flowing down the valley, down the axis of the valley. And over here to the east, it's moving generally southeast towards the Elkhorn River. So by and large, it looks like, based on water level data, the Platte's losing across this whole reach. And here's a look at our stream flows that we measured. We measured these tributaries up here to the north. Fremont pumps a lot of water just for dewatering purposes and puts it in this and big slough here. But generally speaking, these tributaries are gaining flows. They move east towards the Elkhorn River. We have this tributary here to the south that provided about 10.6 cubic feet per second. And we measured here at our stream gauge at Waterloo and also at Q Street down here. And we're picking up about 100 cubic feet per second. That's where in that area we have that really thick permeable aquifer. And so we're going to kind of compare that with what we got in August, kind of our more lower flow condition. So our flows here are generally, as you might guess, a little bit lower. The water level is a little bit lower. To the north, all these groundwater flow directions are really consistent from what we saw previously. But to the south, something interesting happened. All our flow shifted. Instead of going straight to the Elkhorn River, everything pretty much shifted straight south. And we're going to see how that kind of influences stream flows in that case. So we have slightly less flow in our tributaries here to the north, which is kind of what we expected. And I just want to point out that we have about less than half the flow that we saw at that November survey. But I want to point out what we have at Waterloo. So we have about 1,220 cubic feet per second. And at Q Street, we have less. We have 90 CFS less. We have 1,130. So that kind of begs a question. We're pinned up right against the valley wall, the Papio watershed, where everything's going this way. Where'd that extra water go? Basically, what we found out when we our groundwater level slope surface, that's how steep it is. That surface of that groundwater level surface is steeper than the river. So basically what happens is that groundwater actually is going into the stream bed. It's going subsurface as underflow, and it's going to probably reemerge near the confluence there. Hopefully that makes sense. That's a kind of a big point, that when the flows in the Platte drop off, the flow directions change. And so if you're moving forward in a drought mitigation study and you're measuring things and things aren't making sense, there is this thing where the ground directions, the flow directions will change and shift and maybe give you some results that might have you scratching your heads a little bit. Also, as part of this work, to get that kind of that seepage component or that subsurface flow component, we estimated seepage rates in the Elkhorn River where we used heat as a tracer. So basically, we have a bunch of temperature sensors that we've driven into the stream bed. And it measures temperature over time. So if you got a really warm pulse of water during a hot day, how that heat signal propagates into the stream bed, you're able to estimate seepage rates. That's something that's been ongoing. So we collected a couple different spots south of the the Waterloo gauge and then north of the gauge as well. And we're getting some good results with that. That modeling is ongoing right now, so I don't have a lot to show you, I'm afraid. But kind of wrapping things up, hopefully I didn't take too much time. Some of the findings we're seeing is that within that study area, we thought this was going to be a pretty easy, pretty straightforward, pretty understandable project. We're kind of finding it's a little bit more complicated. Instead of being a sandbox in between two rivers, we've got this kind of northern section where it's a relatively thin, fine-grained aquifer. We have these creeks, these little tributaries that act like groundwater drains. To the southern course, we have a really pretty thick, permeable aquifer. The groundwater flow in direction of stream flow is really driven by flows of the Platte River, and we're kind of finding out that more. And stream flow of the Elkhorn River, especially below that gauge at Waterloo, is really dependent on flows and the water levels from the Platte River as well. So I think I threw a lot at everyone right now. If you guys have any questions, I'd be happy to answer anything.
I think the other kind of thing that we learned a little bit is that if you're thinking about water basically losing potentially from the Platte or moving from west to east, it still takes a long time for groundwater to. But what is occurring fairly quickly is that the gradients change. So, for instance, as the gradient changes quite a bit closer to the Elkhorn River, if it goes up, that's that much more discharge that's occurring into the Elkhorn River. And so that's pretty important when you start talking about, because the Elkhorn River ends up being a tributary that adds and provides flow, not directly next to MUD West, but as Lincoln's well fields go, is pretty important to what's flowing down there. So all that kind of pulls together. I think it's, as we finish this into a report, we'll provide that useful information. In terms of what we're looking at as far as a resolution tonight, it's just to continue to have USGS support that one gauge next to Waterloo. Right here next to here to Waterloo is what we're talking about. There's a groundwater gauge well just like this that ties into the recorder at the gauge there. And that's really what's recording the groundwater level and the temperature. That's really all they're maintaining as far as what we're doing. With that, we'd entertain some questions.
Well, why don't you go ahead and read the recommendation and the amount and so forth, please, Bob.
Sure. The recommendation is that management recommends that the subcommittee recommend to the board of directors that the general manager be authorized to execute the proposed joint funding agreement with U.S. Geological Survey in the amount of $3,890 in district funds for operation of the Waterloo, Nebraska groundwater elevation and temperature gauge through September 2018, subject to changes deemed necessary by the general manager and approval as to form by district legal counsel.
Chair, to entertain a motion on. We have a motion. Is there a second, please? Second by Director Klug. Anyone in the public wish to speak to this item? Seeing none, directors? Director Teaser?
I had a question. In one of your opening charts, you said that there were 120 some days of flows under 1,000 CFS. Is
that? I think, yeah, this is a.
Okay. My question is this. It says in the past 27 years, so the share of gauge has only been there 22, so how did you determine the other years?
I think this is at the Louisville gauge.
Oh, that doesn't really mean.
Was that?
I think it's at Ashland.
Is that Ashland? Okay.
Yeah, that's the Ashland gauge. So it's trying to document for the Lincoln public water system.
That's
they consider that kind of their threshold.
Well, if you were 1,000 at Louisville, that's. Or the Elkhorn, that's pretty damn low.
Director Bradley.
Well, I just wondered if any of these gauges or wells measure nitrates. Because I'm thinking, as you were showing that water flowing, I was thinking of that big chicken plant being built in Fremont.
So there's at La Sierra, I can't. I'll do my best to answer this. There's another gentleman in my office that typically handles this, but we have a continuous nitrate sensor that we operate seasonally at Shara and also one at Water. It just recently got pulled, but I think for the past three, we pulled before the ice comes on the river, so we don't damage that sensor. But I think from spring, basically March to October, that's all. That data, I think that's been going on since 2000, maybe longer. That's something that's been ongoing, and I think they're looking to add additional pipe to that nitrate next
time
in response to the chicken.
Okay. Good.
In addition to just that site, we do work with Amanda with USGS also to take periodic sampling across the entire area.
Comment on that nitrate level when you get down to MUD's Flat South plant. When they get low flows, the nitrates get so high, when they start exceeding 10 in the raw water, they have to cut back. And I don't know what it's been in recent years, but low flow in the summer, it's a real critical thing for them.
I don't know if there was – I don't think there's any operating like those continuous nitrates in 2012. I know, and I think we started using them in 2013 in that first – runoff event, that first flush, there was nitrate really, really high. There had
Thank you. Other questions or comments? Seeing none, roll call on the motion, please.
Luke?
Yes.
Peter?
Yes.
Rick Conley?
Aye.
Fowler?
Yes.
Yes, thank you. Now, item 12A. This is Eric Williams. This is Bidsrey Steve for construction on the West Papio Trail, Giles Road to Millard. Good evening.
Good evening, everyone. And Brian Pecka from Big Buddy Workshop is going to join me for this item. Just going to provide a brief update. This is the West Papio Trail section from 108th of Giles, following the West Papio Creek north up to about 132nd and Q. And we do have kind of a little overview of the section of trail, just to remind you where that is and some of the key features of this project. And Brian's going to handle that.
Good evening. My name is Brian Pesca. I'm a project manager and landscape architect at Big Muddy Workshop. It was a year ago in August that our team, consisting of Big Muddy Workshop and JEO Consulting Group, commenced conceptual design and topographic survey services for this project. 1 year and 3 months later, we completed construction documents and put the project out to bid. Just last Tuesday, a week ago from today, we accepted bids, but before we get into the actual bid results, we just wanted, as Eric mentioned, provide just a quick update on the project.
Does this work?
No. Looks like it. Okay. The trail segment that we put out to bid is circled in red there. Some of you may already know the West Papio Trail corridor pretty well. This particular section will provide a vital link in ultimately establishing a continuous trail all the way up from northwest Omaha in this area, down along portions of the trail that are completed in a southeasterly direction, all the way to Bellevue, to where the West Papio Trail currently connects to the Keystone Trail, which is just off of this map down here. So it is a rather important trail section. The piece that we bid is shown in the red dashed line. On the north end, it starts at the intersection of Harry Anderson Avenue and Q Street right there, proceeds southeasterly along the east side of the West Papio Creek, and then ends where the most recently completed section of West Papio Trail ends, just on the south side of Giles Road, right down here. You'll see that there's still this tan line up here is the completed portion of West Papio Trail to the north. You'll see there's a little gap still in there that I'll try to highlight on the next slide. Again, our trail section starts right here at Q Street, which is running east-west, and Harry Anderson Avenue. Ultimately, the final trail corridor is expected to go. This is Tyson Food Plants right here at the intersection of Q and Harry Anderson. Ultimately, the trail is anticipated to go along the west side of Tyson Foods Food Plant, cross under 132nd Street, go underneath Q Street into Anderson Park, cross over the creek right at that location, which would go over to the west side of the creek, go under Millard Avenue, and at that point connect with the existing West Papio Trail. I believe that trail is scheduled perhaps in the next 5 years or so.
This conceptual look was the first time we've looked at that section, so we haven't got any further than the kind of corridor look in 2012.
The existing conditions of this particular trail corridor, many of you may know that this trail section actually runs along what was once the Union Pacific Transcontinental Railroad. And there's actually, if you walk out there or drive nearby, you may see a lot of physical and visual evidence of that by the historic timber and steel bridges that you'll see along that trail corridor. Of course, because it was an old rail bed, that provided us with a lot of opportunity to utilize that as much as possible. Much of that is already cleared, so it minimizes the amount of clearing and grubbing we need to do. It provides a firm base for the trail corridor, so we tried to utilize that as much as possible in the final design. We also wanted to reuse and repurpose the historic bridges as much as we could along that trail corridor. We felt, and I think the stakeholders, NRD, the City of La Vista, and City of Omaha, felt those were unique features that you don't see elsewhere in the metro area. And then one other thing that we felt is somewhat unique to the metro area, especially along trail corridors, is the diversity of habitat and vegetation along this particular trail section. There's portions that have a pretty well-developed tree canopy, as well as open meadow areas consisting of native vegetation. So we think we're going to end up with a real nice trail corridor. we zoom in a little bit more and show a little more detail, here north is up and just a little bit off to your left. So the trail is, trail starts here at Q Street running in this direction, and this is Harry Anderson Avenue running left to right. At this particular intersection, we have a trailhead parking lot planned at that location to accommodate up to 15 stalls so people can readily get to the trail and onto their bikes or start walking at that location. The trail proceeds following Harry Anderson Avenue to a tribute, unnamed tributary that we've dubbed Oakfields Crossing North. I wanted to point out that when you look at the bid results, you'll see we asked for three total bid items. One was the base bid, which basically includes all work associated with this project, with the exception of the channel work and bridge work at this crossing, at Oakfields Crossing North. Here, we asked for two different bid alternates. Bid alternate one being reutilizing this existing bridge, repurposing it, strengthening it, putting in some channel supports with rock riprap and sheet pile. And then bid alternate number two would be if we tore this bridge down and put in a brand new bridge. And again, all the channel improvements associated with that. So hopefully that the bid results will make a little bit more sense to you when you look at that. Proceeding southeasterly, the bridge or the trail will come along another historic bridge, somewhat smaller than the Oakhills Crossing North. We dubbed it Oakhills Crossing South. We've got some channel stabilization included with the project there as well as some improvements to the existing grade control structure. The trail proceeds southeasterly and will go underneath Interstate 80. Just on the south side of Interstate 80, there is an open culvert that has created quite an erosion gully that extends all the way to the creek. So this project will also correct that problem area right now. Continuing on, the trail crosses an existing, much smaller historic bridge, timber bridge. All that will be required on this bridge is to redeck it with concrete and put up some railings for ADA and for code requirements. And then the trail crosses underneath the Burlington Northern Santa Fe rail line. At this location, we have a planned overhead protection structure to help protect trail users from any falling debris that might come off of that rail line. Proceeding southeasterly, the trail will cross Hell Creek along that existing bridge, and then ultimately ending at where the existing West Papua Trail ends, just on the south side of Giles Road. We do have a smaller, I believe it's 9 or 10 parking stalls planned just on the south side or west side of Harry Anderson Avenue to act as a smaller trailhead parking lot for that end of the trail. In summary, the design features is just slightly under 2.8 miles long. Will consist of a 10-foot wide concrete surface trail. I mentioned there will be a trailhead parking lot at both the north and south ends of this trail section. We're planning to repurpose all of the historic railroad bridges as part of this project. And we also have four paved plazas just off of the side of the trail to act both as wayside rest areas for bikers and pedestrians so they can get off and sit down on a bench, with also an interpretive exhibit at each of those locations that talks about the history of the hydrology and the culture of this area. Anything to add here?
There's a couple of key features in this project. Again, the developed tree canopy on the historic railroad corridor, the undercrossing at Interstate 80, the district worked with Omaha and La Vista to stabilize the Hell Creek Bridge previously. That was kind of an emergency repair project. And so we've completed that project already. And then on the north end, it does connect to what was formerly Millard Lumber and is now the Lumber Yard District. And so people are beginning to move into that multi-purpose, multi-story new district. And so they'll have excellent access. We work with Omaha Public Works to see the end of the median pull back a little bit to provide a nice trail crossing on Q Street. So a lot of preparation work has been done so that this can be a really premier trail corridor that provides connectivity between different jurisdictions. And again, we are partnering with Omaha and La Vista, so the cost share on this project is 60% from the NRD, 20% from Omaha, and 20% from La Vista.
If you go to bid results?
Yeah. Can you pull up the bid tab? Should have the other attachment.
I Can you go through this?
Yep, this is good.
I'll go through it? Okay. Yeah, just last Tuesday we received three bids. That was a little scary when you only receive three bids, but we were actually quite happy with the results. We received a bid from K2 Construction out of Lincoln, ME Collins Contracting Company, and Valley Corporation. Again, we asked for a base bid total, which includes all of the work associated with the trail, with the exception of the Oak Hills Crossing North. And then bid alternate number one is to reuse the existing bridge and associated channel improvements with that. And then bid alternate number two was to put in a new pedestrian bridge and all the channel improvements associated with that. On base bid first, the engineer's estimate was almost $2.2 million. Valley was low. They were $2.056. K2 Construction was second, and then ME Collins came in third on the base bid. Valley was almost low by nearly $100,000 from the next lowest bidder, which was K2 Construction. So both K2 and Valley were lower than the engineer's estimate, and ME Collins was higher. Bid alternate number one and two, although Valley Corporation was not low, they were second low, but not by much. So because of that, no matter which bid alternate might be accepted, if you put that in conjunction, add that to the base bid total, Valley Corporation would be low in either scenario. And these provide the final results, depending on whether we would go with alternate number one or alternate number two.
So the conclusion there is that, the engineer's estimate was a very good estimate. We had two bids that were competitive and just below, but still very close to what we had expected. And overall, Valley Corp was low. The difference between two alternates was only about $1,000, negligible in the total cost of the project. And so based on the historic nature of the corridor and the amount of work we put into preservation and information related to the historic railroad corridor, we're recommending to go ahead and use bid alternate number one, which is preserve the existing timber bridge and reuse that, upgrade and reuse that as a new bridge for the trail corridor. That's included in the letter that's attached there from Big Muddy. So they recommend that we select Valley Corp with bid alternate number one. And then the specific recommendation is that subcommittee recommend to the board that the general manager be authorized to execute a contract with Valley Corporation for construction of the West Patio Trail, Bells Road to Miller project for the bid amount of $2,712,822.38. And it's deemed necessary by a general manager and approved list.
Okay, Chair, staff recommendation.
Second. We have a motion and a second. Anyone in the public wish to speak? Seeing none, directors? Director Bradley?
Thank you. On the Transcontinental Railroad, you know it about how old? I'm sure they had updates and everything.
Yep.
But
so we do not believe that any of the structures out there currently are the original structures from the 1860s. But instead, when the new UP main line parallel to what's now the interstate was constructed about 1906, they then transferred over to that line, reconstructed the line south down toward Bellevue. So most of the structures out there are about in 1906. Some of them are stamped in the concrete. When we did the Hell Creek reconstruction, they removed the slab, and below that slab was the footing of the original bridge, and so we do have some of that material from the original bridge, which has been salvaged and is on site and is intended to be potentially reused as part of the interpretive exhibits at Hell Creek. So they're gigantic hand-sawn timbers, you know, entire tree posts were put down there 150 years ago, under concrete, underwater, and have been extremely well-preserved. So there's a lot of history out there. These structures are not those first structures, but they're the second iteration.
Okay. And
any other questions or comments? I have one. How much of this trail are we going to throw away? You're showing another route paralleling to it.
I don't know how many linear feet that is. It's a fairly short section of trail, and it's a fairly simple trail section to construct because it's right along the existing rail.
Why build it now? Why don't we just wait and build the other one?
This will provide a direct connection immediately upon completion of this trail to that lumber yard district that Eric was referring to. And there's a series of new sidewalks and smaller trail sections in that area that this will actually connect to.
So Yeah, all of the corridor, the neighborhoods are primarily to the east side of the existing trail, and it becomes much more kind of commercial, retail, industrial. And so access to all of the neighborhoods north and east from 132nd and Q, if they were to follow Q Street down to the Q Street bridge access point, they would be crossing lots of driveways in a high traffic area. The connection here allows both an interim connection to the Lumberyard District right away, down to kind of a trail spur, essentially. And then long-term, it prevents people needing to go down Q Street in that kind of complicated area to get to the underpass section. And the timing on the next project is uncertain right now. It's going to be quite complicated. There's a few major hurdles, the three bridge underpasses, and a very large culvert that the end outlet will need to be constructed. So we'll have to work with Omaha on that. And so the timing on when that will become available is uncertain right now, probably several years in the future due to the planning and pre-work that will need to be done. But the existing spur will provide access to the new Lumberyard District right away. And as Brian said, the cost for that section compared to the total cost of the project is relatively low because they'll already be out, already mobilized and pouring concrete, and continuing to pour concrete from the section where the creek pulls away from Harry Anderson up to Q Street is relatively inexpensive compared to the total scope of the project. So that's why we decided to continue this project all the way up to where it's most accessible at the intersection by Q Street now.
And do we have the land for the trailheads?
Yes, there's no land acquisition in this project. It was previously purchased as part of the 100-foot rail corridor back in about 20.
It doesn't. Does it include at the north end of Q Street? Does it include the structure in there, like the old gas station, or?
No, there was previously a license agreement from the adjacent property just to the west, allowing them to have access into that parking lot and essentially through the parking lot to Harry Anderson. We've been in contact with them to let them know that we are moving forward with the trail. Our license agreement required that either they construct the parking lot, or by the time we got the trail there, we would construct the parking lot, and we would then ask them to reimburse us for the cost. So we had sent them notification of the expected cost of the trailhead parking lot, and we expect they will reimburse us at the time. So when the construction is complete, they will not decide to preemptively construct the trailhead parking lot before we get there about June.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments? Roll call, please.
Hazer?
Yes.
Rick Connell?
Aye.
Fowler?
Yes.
Luke?
Yes.
Yes. Now we have a 12B item.
This is a secondary item that comes along with the same trail project. Now that we have completed bidding, that is the end of the original scope for Big Muddy Workshops and professional administration services. At this point, we have asked them to provide a scope for the construction admin services all the way through the remaining portion of the project, and that's attached. We've updated the contract documents, and so what we've got proposed or what we've got attached here is Exhibit K, which is an amendment to the original agreement that would have been signed back in August 5th, 2016, and then also a slight change on Exhibit D, which is the project representative on site. So those are the documents that are attached here, and a description of the services of the engineer, and that would be JDO doing some of that structural and more technical engineering work, and Big Muddy doing the trail and landscape portion of that work. The original contract was $409,000, I believe.
Yes.
And so the recommendation here through negotiation with them was for a new contract of $203,839. To handle all of the construction administration services needed from now through the preliminary work in the winter and then into beginning of construction, starting as soon as it gets warm, probably about April, and then wrapping up about September of 2018. And so this would be an amendment to the original contract for them to continue their work, see construction all the way through.
Chair and entertain a motion.
So moved.
Okay. Anyone in the public wish to speak? Seeing none, directors? Roll call.
Rick Connelly?
Aye.
Fowler?
Yes.
Luke?
Yes.
Hazer?
Yes.
Yes. I believe that finally concludes our agenda. Thank you.
We need to take a break?
Yeah.
5 minutes? Okay.
That was a long meeting.
A lot of information. Do you the gavel, Rich?
You're at the gavel, Rich?
No, no, thank you.
Fowler, where are you going?
We're calling the meeting of the FPL Committee to order. And we're going to ask Fred to sit in for Jim Thompson. And with that, notification of the Open Meeting Act is outside and posted in the back of the room. With that, quorum call.
Bradley?
Here.
Fred Conley?
Here.
John Conley?
Here.
Reese?
Here.
And here. Adoption of the agenda.
So moved. Second.
Roll call.
Fred Conley?
Aye.
John Conley?
Yes.
Reese?
Yes.
Bradley?
Yes.
Yes. Proof of publication of the meeting notice. I have it here before me. Moving on, discussion of draft fiscal year 2017 audit. Carrie and Gene. Gene, I'm sorry you had to sit back for all of you.
That's all right. I continue to learn more and more about
it. You will. Good evening.
All those kind of things. So, very informative. Well, good evening. Glad to be here tonight. Appreciate the opportunity to present the draft of the audited financial statements and our work to you this evening. And so we'll identify some work on there, but I think everybody has an outline of the summary of the kind of a high level deal. What I thought I would do is just take you through the audit, what our role is, the items that we need to report to you, and then we can certainly dive into the financial statements more in more detail if you'd all like to do that. So on page 1 and 2 of the report is actually our opinion on the financial statements. That's what you hire us to do, is to issue an opinion on the financial statements, whether we determine whether they're fairly presented in all material respects. And that all material respects is an important verbiage, because it doesn't mean we looked at every transaction and that every dollar is in the right location or properly accounted for. So there's a materiality level that we look at, meaning is there anything that's significant or material that a user would not be able to rely on these to inform them about the financial operations and the situation of the district. So our opinion is unqualified. What that means is there's no qualifications to it. That's the type of report you want. Is an unqualified opinion, meaning we're not qualifying our opinion for any misstatement of items or anything that's not reported. Same report you've received every year that we performed this service. In the back of the report, the last couple pages, there's a second component of an audit of financial statements, and that is that we're required to report to you compliance with laws, regulations, and internal controls. Now, we don't design our audit to identify or look for non-compliance with any laws and regulations, and we don't design our audit to give an opinion on your internal controls. Those are just byproducts, if you will, of the audit process. So what those reports do on page 53 and 54, report there were no deficiencies in internal controls over financial reporting. Same report you've had in previous years, and again, the size of staff that you have, the system internal controls you've developed within the number of people is quite admirable because of that. And part of it is because Mr. Conley or your assistant treasurer will come in and sign checks and review all the documentation on a very detailed, thorough basis. And that provides a lot of support for that, you know, for that internal control system. That's an important part of that process. In addition to that, we look for, during the course of our audit, and we look for certain items of compliance with laws and regulations, and our report says that we did not identify any material matters of noncompliance. However, the state auditor's office requires that we report to them all instances of certain items, whether they're material or not material, and that's what's reported in there is a budget compliance matter. So what happened during the current fiscal year is the district adopted a budget to operate the district. And then during the year, you determined it was appropriate to refund your bonds, meaning refinance them. So a major refunding of $40 million of refunding, meaning you refinance them at a lower rate, saved $2 million of future costs, but that was not in your original budget, and the budget was not amended for that. And so technically there is a non-compliance matter that refunding of those bonds was not budgeted, and then you did it. So even though the refunding was public, it was approved by all of you in a public meeting, it's still a technicality that we had to report. We report in there because state auditor wants all items of budget non-compliance reported. If you go to, I thought we'd just go to page 39 of the audit report, because I think because there's a non-compliance thing there, I want to show everybody what that actually looks like. So on 39 of the audit report is where the budget schedules are reported. So in the middle two columns is your original and final budget. There were no changes during the year. You didn't adopt any changes to your budget. So on the expenditure side, well, on the revenue side, you had budgeted potential revenues coming in of $45,072,000. You actually collected $33,176,000, so $11,895,000 less than what was actually budgeted. On the expense side, you budgeted expenditures of $66,213,000. You actually expended $38,745,000, so you underspent the budget that you all approved by $27,467,000. Down in that bottom section is where it shows where the other financing sources and uses. We issued refunding bonds of $46,248,000, and you paid outstanding bonds of $45,654,000, including the transfers in there. The net amount is $483,000, but what the state budget law says is you should budget for both those items of, you know, that refunding. So that's the item that's reported. And so as part of that, you can see when you read our report that we don't determine that as it was what we consider to be a material non-compliance matter. So that's how that is reported. Okay, so going back to the summary, the bullet point summary. The third section, the third bullet point is the audit of federal award programs. In the past, we've audited when you do have federal award programs where you receive more than $750,000 of federal funding, we're required to do specific procedures over those federal award programs. During this fiscal year, the district did not receive that threshold. It received less than $750,000 of federal funding, so there was no audit requirement of those federal awards this year. Included in there's a separate letter in there also. It's required communications to any governing body that an audit is performed with. It's mostly just it's qualitative issues of matters with an audit. It's just communication to you that we worked well with the district and didn't identify any matters of disagreement. There were no outside accountants used as part of this audit on either side, either on the district side or our side. It notes what we determined to be the most significant disclosures in the financial statements, and then we have to report to you all the adjustments that came out of the audit. What entries in the accounting system were made as a part of the audit? And so those are attached, and there's about there's four or five of those. All of those entries relate to the bond recording of bond transactions. And so I wouldn't necessarily call these errors because that's part of what Carrie is and John have asked us to do. There's some very technical bonding entries to make and how you record it, because we have this full accrual basis of accounting on the government-wide statements. We have modified accrual accounting for these fund financial statements, and then you have your budgetary financial statements, and there's different treatment and different that. So it's kind of a technical matter of just how they gets reported in here. And so Carrie really has asked us to help her and prepare those entries. So I wouldn't characterize any of those entries as errors or mistakes. It's just part of what we do as part of our audit process. But as part of that, we need to tell you and disclose to you that we may help Carrie make those entries and post those entries. Did I characterize that correctly? Okay. There was one item in there that we changed the reporting on, and still goes back to bonds. The accounting standards changed how they want to do bond costs. You used to have bond costs, and the cost that you pay essentially your underwriters to prepare the bonds and sell them and all of that, that you would take that cost and you would expense it, amortize it over the life of the bonds. The accounting standards want those expensed just in the year you pay them. And so we did not do that last year. And so rather than just kind of let those run out for another 10 or 15 years, we felt it was appropriate just to write them off this year. All the bond costs that had been capitalized in the prior years, which was $140,000. It only affects your government-wide statements. So it's just a matter of the standard setters in for the accounting industry decided they wanted to make the change on how that's presented. So that entry is in there. Some other observations and recommendations just on the course of the audit. I do want to note that the district did make some improvements in their internal controls. And when they implemented the new payroll system, they did a very good job of developing, designing internal controls over that payroll process. There are a couple of little tweaks that we talked about doing to continue to further tighten those up. But again, I don't have any issues or concerns with your internal controls, as we did not report any significant deficiencies or material weaknesses in those controls. The second bullet point under our observations or recommendations is when I look at these financial statements, and I'm sure as you do and the public does, they're not the easiest financial statements to understand what this district's doing and how it's all working. And I think that the users of these, the value to the users could be enhanced if you all expanded your management discussion analysis, which is on the first five or six pages of this report, or you develop a comprehensive annual financial report, which is a significant document that adds, the big thing that would add is a statistical section of data in the back of this, and that would give 10-year trends on bonds, on taxes, on assets, on leverage ratio, on tax ratio compared to different things. So we've talked about that in the past. I think you can accomplish that without maybe covering all those, and maybe the step would be is maybe expanding the management discussion and analysis next year, and then maybe a step after that might be expanding some more of those. But I think that some of those statistical tables and long-term data might help the users understand and use these financial statements to the public a little bit better to understand, because you're not here, you're not understanding, you don't always kind of get what all the district is doing and what all the resources went and how they're managing their assets and resources and debt. So. And then the third recommendation is as we during the course of this recommended that you make some tweaks to when a budget item needs to come to you for if it's going to be over expending at the 110%. And there's some items in there we just had brought up to John and Carrie that maybe just to tweak that a little bit to maybe tighten that up on and clarify maybe when something needs to come in and not particularly The matter there is when you have a small budget and you end up spending significant amount of money. So it's a small budget item, but so it's below the threshold of getting approval, but then that number grows to a significant number. And so the item we identified really had it wasn't a controllable expansion. It was actually the election fees, where the budget of election fees was small, but because of the elections that went on, the number was significant. And it didn't have board approval and didn't require to under the budget. So that particular expense wasn't worrisome to me, but you could have other items that in the future that might be. So we want to tighten that up and look at tightening up that control a little bit. So there's kind of our comments or my comments on just our audit in the process. Any questions on those? And then I would kind of give some comments and highlights on the financial statements themselves. Anybody have any questions before
any director with comment?
Okay. So I got five or six bullet points. Oh, I'm sorry.
Sorry, if that was a little slow.
Yeah, that's okay.
I'm raising the hand. One, two, three, four, five bullet points down. It says observations and recommendations, financial highlights. Mm-hmm. I think on page one. The district made some improvements. to its internal controls during the year, but further improvements could be made through increased staffing. So, saying we need maybe hire some?
No, I'm saying that my point is, with the current staffing you have, I'm not sure there's much else you can do. So the only way you're going to kind of tighten those controls would be to have additional staffing. I mean, bringing other people in from other departments or adding people there would really be the next step to improving or tightening your internal controls.
Okay, for checks and balances? Or?
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
Yep.
Any other address or comments? Before I open it up to the public, I do want to advise the public there will be a 3-minute time limit for questions. And I presume, Sean, you'd like to speak? Go ahead.
So do you want me to review the overview of the financials first, Mr. Teaser?
I'm sorry?
Can I just comment on the overall?
Yes,
let me do that first.
I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, that's okay. That's fine. I just wanted to clarify because I think it'd be better. We just waited till then. So overall, my observations of how the district did and what's important in these financial statements. So overall, the net position, that's the term that we use for governmental entities as a whole, equity on a full accrual basis, how would a business look at this? So your equity increased by almost $11 million, $10.99. Well, how did that happen? Well, a lot of governments will collect taxes, collect resources, and spend the money on services, and their equity doesn't change. Well, you collect revenues, and then you build things. And those build things are assets, and then those assets get depreciated over a long period of time. And so as you're building assets, this equity number is going up. So that's how that happens. The next one, it tells you actually what you have in net capital assets. So the net investment in capital assets increased by $17 million to a total of $170 million. Well, what is net investment in capital assets? So that's all the trails, all the dam sites, all the facilities that you own, less the bonds that you, the debt that you owe on that money. So it's all the assets you've built that you still own, less the debt you have. So the net of that is $170 million. So $220-some million of total assets minus $67 million of debt ends up roughly giving you that $170 million of assets. Now, those assets, again, are getting depreciated over the life of the asset, what it is. So third bullet point is the long-term debt is a $66.4 million compared to $67.2 million, so it's down $800,000. The fourth bullet point is really how is the current the fund balance for the general fund. And now this fund balance takes a completely different perspective. This is how I manage my current resources, my cash, my receivables primarily. That's what it's measuring, less my current liabilities. So the general fund actually decreased by $7.4 million. So you have, at the end of June, you had $7.4 million less of cash and receivables than you had a year ago. Well, why is that? Well, a year ago, you had $9 million of money sitting in reserve to spend on projects. You spent that money, so that balance goes down. Unrestricted fund balance decreased by $531,000 to $25.5 million, so not much difference there. And then the water funds, the proprietary funds, those all increased. And as you if you look at all of those, the district, I mean, every one of those has made progress. And they're getting close to the point where I think you can say they're self-sustaining, which was not the case just a few years ago. So I think all of your water districts are making progress as planned and seem to be close to being relatively self-sustaining projects.
What is your depreciation schedule on those projects?
Yeah, most of the big projects is like 50 years. So the dam sites would be 50 years. Trails, do you remember what the trails are? They're not that long. They're shorter time frame. 30 years, I think.
Do you do it straight across the board?
So spread evenly throughout that.
In the back?
Spread evenly throughout that period of time.
Okay. What do we depreciate as far as what we're spending money on? I guess where I'm coming with this is sometimes it probably would be not to our advantage to depreciate something because of the cost basis.
Right. So there's and the government financial statements really present it two ways. On the government-wide statements, it requires you to capitalize and depreciate these items over this expected lifetime. And that's what's on the first two financial statements are that. And then following that are financial statements where you don't depreciate them, capitalize. You show it, you spend the money, you expense it. You show it as an expense. So there's two ways that these statements actually show that is, you know, those two methods. And that's, you know, how the government standards are set up so people can look at it. If we depreciate, here's what we have. If we just expense the money, here's what we have.
So basically everything we do, we depreciate it?
Not everything you do. If it's an asset that you own, then you would. So, for example, the money approved this evening, maybe on the study or the study or something like that, you wouldn't. But, you know, the trail, absolutely, that would be capitalized and depreciated.
Other questions?
Let's see.
Thank you. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We have a public comment. Gentlemen, again, 3 minutes.
Sean Malotz, 10404 North 132nd Street. I had a couple issues / questions I have in the budget that I'd like to get answered. On page 9, there is a reference or a statement to the third bullet point that says there's $91.7 million that is the estimated cost on the six dams that was proposed in the budget. And then it goes on to mention that this $91.7 million is funded in part by watershed fees collected by the zoning jurisdictions. I'd like to get a dollar amount or an estimated percent that represents so we can understand that for taxing purposes. On page 30, the footnote on due from funding agencies, there's a note in there that there's $7.5 million that's due from other government agencies. If you could please provide a list of the government agencies, the dollar amount, and the expected collection dates on those items. That would be appreciated.
Sean, do you have these written down?
Yes, I do.
Okay, great. Is that what you
need? On page 31, capital assets, if you could provide a detail of the transfers that make up the $3.7 million that are transfers out of the capital assets, which is the second column from the right. That's what I'd like to do. If you could get that before Thursday's meeting, that would be greatly appreciated.
Yeah, just a minute.
That's great. Yep.
Okay,
thank you.
Is there any other comment?
From the public?
I'm sorry?
You can come back from the public.
Okay. Anybody else from the public wish to speak? We don't need a motion here, do we? This is just. Any other controversial comment?
I'm going to save my compliments for the accounting staff until Thursday night, but I'm certainly not sitting here unaware of what they've done for us.
Very impressive. Seeing no further business, we stand adjourned.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.